Okay, let's finish up today on lesson 13. Before I do that, let me just remind you first that we have this quiz coming up next Tuesday, so our next class session will be a test, and give you one last opportunity to speak now or forever hold your peace on any particular problems you might have from chapter 7 to 11 and those accent rules that we've covered. If you think of something during the course of the class, go ahead and pop up and ask it too. Yes.
I think I wrote it down wrong in the paradigm chart, but on the sum of the kinds, first example, first equation, it starts out with an alpha ending, and switches back to a theta, and then it goes back to an alpha.
Yes, right. Nominative and accusative are alpha type, and genitive and dative are eta type. Right. Okay. That's one thing. If you suspect that you may have written something down wrong on your paradigm, be sure and check with another student or check with me or something before you memorize it. Okay? We don't want to burn it into the brain cells and then have to change it, you know? Okay? That's one thing you don't want to make a mistake with. All right. And then, of course, you can confirm it from your textbook. It's there. It's just there in bits and pieces. You have to... This book is a pretty good book, but one of the weaknesses, in my opinion, is the lack of, you know, charts where the whole paradigm is put down. So I'll just be supplying you that on the board here. Okay, any other questions? Well, let's look at these verbs again in lesson 13. We had just gotten to the point yesterday of talking about the distinction between first and second aorist at the bottom of page 77. And so the first thing I want to say is that the aorist that we've seen so far, the regular form of the aorist, is the aorist tense is made by adding an augment to the base on the front, adding sigma, and then adding these endings, alpha, alpha, sigma, epsilon, amen, atet, an. That set of endings is at the top of page 77. Now, that unfortunately isn't the only way the aorist is made. And that's what we want to talk about here. Now, you'll see some examples. Then we went on to talk about the fact that when the sigma is added to a stem, the same kinds of changes happen in the aorist as happen in the future with certain types of consonantal endings. You'll get the sigma and that consonant combining to form another consonant, like either C or C or just plain sigma. Okay. Now, and that's what we looked at yesterday, this chart comparing the futures and the aorists from the presents that end in these various forms. So really there's nothing new there, as you didn't know already if you know that little chart that indicates these changes. Now, in part number 6 here, verbs which have aorist forms with the endings given in 3 above, you know, that set of endings right at the top, are said to have first aorist. And the forms are called first aorist forms. Most verbs have first aorist, and the majority of these verbs form their aorist regularly as set forth in 3 above. So the majority of your verbs are first aorist, and the majority of them form their aorist just like the rules that we've seen here with those endings above. Some verbs, however, form their first aorist irregularly or by suppletion. Now, this is still first aorist. So there are regular first aorists and there are irregular first aorists, and then we'll see another class called second aorist. So, in other words, the fact that a Greek verb may be irregular doesn't necessarily mean it's second aorist. It may be still first aorist, but it may be an irregular first aorist. And this is where perhaps the stickiest distinctions come in as far as verb forms are concerned. There's probably more confusion about the idea of first and second aorists and regular and irregular first aorist than maybe any other thing I can point to as far as the verb form is concerned. So we're going to take some time and slug through this piece by piece so you can really see what's happening. Glenn?
When verbs are irregular first aorist, can they be also, are they irregular also like the present?
Oh,
are they regular all through there and suddenly irregular?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. In other words, some verbs are irregular just about every place. Verbs like the verb to be and so forth, they're just irregular everywhere. But let me put it this way. The fact that a verb is irregular in the aorist may not mean that it's irregular anyplace else. That may be the only place it's irregular. And it just kind of depends on the verb. That's why that if you... After a while, you can take a look at these principal parts and you can get a pretty good idea as to how irregular the thing happens to be. Some of them are real nice, except for, say, the future and the aorist, where that sigma's got to be added on. That's where they get funny. And they're real regular every place else. Others may be irregular in almost every position. It depends basically on just the kind of verb you're dealing with and the kind of form that's there. But to answer the question, I would say no, it doesn't necessarily mean it may be irregular only in the aorist. That may be the only place where it's irregular. And so some of the first verbs we're going to be looking at here are, well, I guess they kind of range the gamut here. There's, you know, some of them are irregular just about every place. Some of them are irregular only in the aorist. So we'll even get into some other complications later on where passive forms are used for active meaning and this kind of thing. We get deponent verbs and lots of things of that nature. When you get things like that happening too, then you have tendency to have a lot more irregularities all throughout the paradigm. Okay. So let's put it this way. There's two basic categories of aorists, the first aorist and the second aorist. Those two categories are determined essentially by the ending systems that they take. The first aorists take these alpha-type endings here. The second aorists, as you'll see, take a different set of endings. So it's really the endings that are telling you basically whether it's first or second aorist. It's not necessarily a stem change. Now, it's true that second aorist will have a stem change, but it's also true that irregular first aorist will have a stem change. But the thing that's determining whether it's first or second aorist is essentially the endings that are on them. Okay, and we'll see this as we go. Now, some verbs form their first aorist irregularly or by suppletion. And remember what suppletion is. It's a change somewhere in the middle, as opposed to a suffix or a prefix or something like that. It is advisable to commit the most important of these to memory. Among the most common are the following. So he gives you five of them here, and it would be wise for you to learn these five. I don't think on the first test I give you on this I may not require all five. Dido me and tithe me are me verbs, and it's a different conjugation, and I don't know if we'll worry about those for too much right now. But these verbs have an irregular first aorist, and you'll notice here that dido me, the aorist is edoka, tithe me, the aorist is etheka, phero, the aorist is anenka. It's hard to even know that they came from the same word. Krino has an aorist ekrina, and see what's the irregular thing there is you have no sigma on the stem. See, it's ekrina. You normally get a sigma, and meno the same thing, emena. And they're all first aorist because notice that alpha ending. That's the alpha ending system you see is being used. This is the first person singular form. And so they are first aorists. They've got that alpha ending. But they're irregular first aorists, and the reason they're irregular is that the stem of the aorist is different than the stem of the present, even including the idea of the sigma. In other words, the regular pattern is to take the stem of the present, put an augment on it, put a sigma on it, and then put the ending on it. But in these, you don't see that. In fact, in all of these, you see no sigma, and you also see a stem change of some sort. Something has happened to the middle of the word one way or another. Either it's just that there's no sigma added, and like in the last two forms, or in the first three forms, there's really a basic change in the vowels and the whole structure of the word. This is what we call suppletion. So they're irregular first aorists. First aorists because they do retain the alpha endings, but irregular in that the stem has changed somehow or something that's predicted according to the rules does not occur, so forth. Okay? But remember that the fact that they've got the alpha endings is what's determining that they're first aorists. Now, there aren't very many of these, but there's enough to worry about. See, so that's why we have to make note of this. Now, the first aorist paradigms of verbs in the above list are formed by dropping alpha of the third principal part, given in the second column, and adding the endings given in three above. So the third principal part is what's given here, this first aorist form in the second column here. That's really the third principal part. Remember, the third principal part is the aorist form. And to form all the rest of the aorist forms, you just take that third principal part, knock the alpha off, and put out whatever ending that you need from that system. So in other words, he's just telling you that they use a first person singular form for the principal part, and then if you wanted to make a third person plural or something like that, then you're just going to use the appropriate ending, and instead of alpha ending, it'll be alpha nu for third person plural. So that's all he's really saying there. Okay, are there any questions on these statements so far? So our normal pattern for first aorist is to add the augment, add a sigma to the base, and add these alpha endings. But there are irregular first aorists which for some reason don't, either they don't add the sigma or they change the stem somehow, but they still retain the augment and the alpha endings. Those would be called irregular first aorists. Okay. And for you, for right now, the most important ones to take note of are the last three in this list: Pharo, Crino, and Meno. And if you learn those for right now, you'll be in good shape. But I'll remind you when the test comes on this section, which will be a little while down the road, just exactly what you'll be responsible for. Okay, now, in addition to the fact that there are irregular first aorists, there are also a number of important verbs that have second aorists. And that is, their aorists are formed irregularly or by suppletion, and they have, instead of the endings given in three above, the endings of the imperfect given in two above. Verbs of this type must be memorized. Some of the most important are listed below. Okay, now we have a different kind of aorist, a second aorist. Now, as I said yesterday, the meaning of the first aorist and the second aorist is the same. There's no distinction in meaning. They're both aorist forms. They both convey the idea of indefinite aspect in past time. So the meaning is no different at all. But the forms are different. And the second aorist forms, instead of doing what we saw before, taking stem, adding sigma, putting an augment on it, and adding the alpha endings, and what they do instead is have some sort of a stem change in the stem itself, usually a more radical stem change than some of the other ones had, and then, instead of adding alpha endings, they just add the augment, a radical stem change of some sort, or at least some kind of stem change, and then the imperfect endings that we saw before. Now, the imperfect endings were given on the bottom, page 76, in part number 2 there. And it's omicron nu, epsilon sigma, epsilon with optional nu, omen et on. Yes. Glenn?
Even though they're not imperfect things.
Right.
They also have an imperfect form with a regular stem?
Yes, exactly. They'll have an imperfect form where the stem doesn't change, and then their aorist form will have the same endings, but the stem does change. So, there's an example coming up here in a moment, so we'll be able to see it. But that's the only way you'll know the difference, because the endings will be the same. So you really have to know what that root form was. You see, if you come across a second aorist form that you've never seen before, and you don't know what the vocabulary is and don't know what the root is, it's easy to mistake that for an imperfect form because you're seeing imperfect type endings. And the only way you'll really know, unless you already know the vocabulary word, is to look it up in the lexicon and find out. And usually that's where your analytical lexicon will help you, because you'll look up the form that you see and it'll take you back to and tell you it's second aorist. So it's just a matter of knowing the words and knowing the vocabulary to know which is which. And of course, if you see both words in the same context, one of them with one stem, one with the other, then you'll be aware at least that one of them is a second aorist. You may not know which is which because they both have the same ending. You don't know whether this was the imperfect form and the other one was the aorist or vice versa. But if you have learned the vocabulary of that word, then you'll know. Okay? So let's look at this chart here, indicating some of the most common and important second aorist type verbs. Lepo, meaning to leave. The future is lepso, which is following the rules that we've seen predictably, adding a sigma to the P, to the P is becoming C. But the aorist is elepon, elepon. Now notice what's happened to that aorist form. We have the augment, all right, but notice the stem, instead of lape, it's lip. So we have changed the stem. The epsilon has dropped out. So we've got a different vowel in the stem. So there's been a stem change. And then we have the omicron nu ending, which is the imperfect type of ending. Now, what would be Now, let me just tell you this. The imperfect of this verb is formed very regularly. What would be the imperfect first person singular form? Yes, elepon, elepon. Okay? So the difference would be, for the aorist, it's elepon, and the imperfect is elepon. That's the only difference between the aorist and the imperfect there. There's been a stem change, but the ending systems are the same. So now, if you knew that the verb was lepo, then you would know that this was a second aorist, because there's been a stem change and we have the imperfect endings. That's why he's telling you what these most important ones are, so you can memorize them, so you'll recognize them when you see them. Okay, ago, same thing. In the future is oxo. That's really regular, because all you've done is added a sigma to the gamma. Remember, gamma sigma combination becomes c, so oxo would be the form you'd expect. But in the aorist, it's agagon. Agagon. Well, that's certainly not predictable, because you've got quite a stem change here. And added a whole syllable, in fact. So that's the second aorist. Now, the imperfect for this form would be what? Can you predict what it would be according to the rules?
Agon.
Yeah, agon. Agon, yeah, with an eta. Now, of course, you see the alpha, putting an epsilon in front of the alpha to make the augment is going to change it to eta. But other than that, you just add those endings. So agon would be the imperfect, but agagon is the second aorist. So there's been a stem change, even though the endings are the same. Okay, heurisco, meaning to find. The future, heureso. Now that's irregular, because we've got a stem change in the future. That's the reason why the future is the second principal part, because you can't always predict is what it's going to do. And huron is the aorist. And that's quite a change again in the stem. Okay, and the imperfect of that, I think, is that one could be irregular in the imperfect too. I'd have to check it. Okay, probably is okay. Just be euriscon then for the imperfect if it's regular, and I assume it is. There's no mention of it otherwise. But the stem has changed for the aorist, huron. Echo, to have, becomes hexo in the future. Now, would you call that regular or irregular? Yes, it's irregular because it's rough breathing. He's got a footnote here to make so you pay attention to that. But you started with a smooth breathing and you got a rough breathing. The xi is predictable, you know, because the chi plus the sigma would result in xi. But the rough breathing is unusual. Now, the aorist is eskon, and this has also got an irregular imperfect. It's echon in the imperfect instead of echon like you might expect. So this one's kind of irregular all along. But notice there is a difference. The imperfect and the aorist are both irregular, but they are different. Their irregularities differ, so that you won't confuse the two. Hamartano, meaning to sin, in the future is hamarteso. That's irregular. See, and again, things that end in nu are generally going to be irregular one way or another, because they don't like to put a nu sigma combination, so something else usually happens. And so in this case, it's hamarteso. You get eta sigma there, and so you do have a sigma, but the stem has changed. And then in the aorist, it's hamarton. Okay? In the imperfect, it would just be hamartanon. It's keeping the same stem. But here you have a stem change for the aorist. Okay, that's what we mean by second aorist. Now, note that the imperfect always, except for a very few verbs, has the augmented present base. The second aorist never has the present base, but always some variation of it. So in other words, he's saying there's been a stem change somehow. It's not the same as the present base, whereas the imperfect does have the present base, with just a few exceptions like echon. The imperfect and aorist of lepo, leave, are given below for comparison. So here's the full paradigm of these. In the imperfect, it's elepon, elepes, elepen, elepomen, elepete, and elepon. In the aorist, though, it's elepon, elepes, elepen, elepomen, elepete, and elepon. So it's just the only difference between those two paradigms is an epsilon in the imperfect and no epsilon in the aorist in that stem. So it just has been a stem change, but the endings are the same, the augments the same, everything's the same except for that stem. Okay. And one simply has to know what the situation is in a verb. You need to know that it's second aorist. Okay, so when you're in the looking in the analytical and you look up a form and it's an aorist form and they say second aorist, you'll know what that's referring to. It's not really a difference in meaning. It's only a difference in form. The way it forms its aorist is different than the way the first aorist form. And the essential difference, at least on the surface, is the ending systems are different. That's the quickest way to tell which one you're looking at. When you see an alpha type ending, you know you're looking at a first aorist. When you see an epsilon type ending, you're looking at a second aorist. Note, however, though, if you happen to be looking at a third person singular form, then it's going to be a little bit more ambiguous because the endings for the first and second aorist happen to be the same there, epsilon nu, or epsilon with movable nu. So if you happen to be looking at a third person singular form, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to tell unless you know the verb, whether you're dealing with the first or second aorist. You can't tell just by looking at the ending because the ending's the same in that particular form. Okay? The meaning of the aorist and the imperfect. So now we want to talk about the meaning. Any questions now about the forms? That's the worst of it. Now we've gotten through the worst of it, you know, to find out that there's a first and second aorist and to find out that there are irregular first aorists as well. Now we want to talk about the meanings. Yes, Glenn?
I think I'm confused.
Okay. That's all right. That's what we're here for, to get you unconfused if we can.
You're saying that verbs have a verb to go, and either a first aorist or a second aorist, or is there a first aorist and then a second aorist also that you see also, but they both mean the same thing?
No. What I'm saying is any given verb will have either a first or a second aorist. In other words, it will form its aorist either one way or the other. In other words, you're not going to have verbs... Well, there is an exception to this. Yeah. There are a few verbs that have both a first and second aorist. And usually that's done because they're giving a different shade of meaning to the verb or something. There's a footnote over here, in fact, on footnote 1 on the next page. Thus the past tense of dive may be dived or dove, and the aorist of hamartano may be hamartesa, first aorist, or hamartone, second aorist. So there are a few verbs that will have both of them, and there are some a little bit later on that have both of them with a different meaning. When we get to the me verbs and so forth, there's a very interesting thing that's done there where they have a first and a second aorist, and the first aorist has a transitive idea, the second aorist doesn't, or something like that. You know, it's almost changed the meaning of the verbs. But those are very few unusual situations. Your most common situation is that a verb will have only either a first or a second aorist. In other words, it'll form its aorist either in the first pattern or in the second pattern. And so you need to be aware of both patterns that exist. And then there's a few exceptional cases in which it may have both. Sometimes, like hamartano, may have both with the same meaning. In other situations, there may be a different meaning even involved. But those are just kind of minor points as an exceptional, you know. The general rule is either a first or a second aorist. It'll form its aorist one of those two ways. Okay, and any other questions on that? All right. The meaning of the aorist and the imperfect. The first aorist and the second aorist are not two different tenses, but two different ways of forming the same tense. So that's what we mentioned before. There's no difference in the meaning, basically. Thus, elusa and elipon are both aorist forms, just as walked and sang are both forms of the English past tense. Very few verbs have both first and second aorist, just as few English verbs have two sets of past forms. When two sets of forms do occur, the difference in meaning is usually negligible, and that's what he mentions down here. Now, he has to say usually because there are some places where it's not negligible.
Are the forms interchangeable?
Oh, I see. Like in this case of hamartano, for example, where it has both of them. Yeah, that's yes, it would be interchangeable.
I don't.
Right. Right. There wouldn't be any problem there. So if the two forms are there, the only thing that might determine which form you use is the author may be used to using one form in his speech as opposed to another, so he's got a preference for that one. Or it may involve, in Hebrew they often make distinctions on the basis of rhyme and meter and this type of thing. That probably wouldn't be the case in Greek, but they would be interchangeable. And the fact is, you'll see both of those, like hamartesa and hamartone, you'll see both of those in the New Testament. And there isn't any distinction in meaning. Yes?
In the case of dive, mm-hmm. Dive is really an improper form. It's a bad English form. I guess it's accepted by common usage.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an improper form.
Well,
is that the case with?
Not that isn't the case with the Greek. In the Greek, it's not an improper form. It's just that they formed it both, you know, formed both ways. Just had two ways of forming it. So it's not bad Greek to have, you know, in English it may be bad English. I don't know where, you know, all these things originate in English, but in Greek there's no indications of a bad grammar or anything in this. They just formed it two ways.
Like convention,
yeah.
We're taught.
Right.
It's not right.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember. Yeah, you can get into a lot of arguments about that, but as far as the Greek is concerned, there's no indication of any bad grammar there. Those forms are both used in the New Testament. They're both transmitting this meaning. And see, you've got two systems for forming the endings that you're already familiar with, and this verb just happens to form it both ways. Okay? Now, the next paragraph, we have already said that the Greek imperfect usually expresses progressive action in past time, and that the aorist refers to a less definite sort of action. When we come to render the Greek forms into English, we find that there is no one-to-one correspondence that will lighten our task. The table below illustrates something of the range of meaning the Greek forms and some of the possible English equivalents. So really what the bottom line is that it's not a simple matter of finding a simple way to translate the aorist that you can use every time and a simple way to translate the imperfect that you can use every time and never get into any problems. What's really necessary is to come to an understanding of the difference grammatically between the two forms, and then in a given situation render a translation that tries to reflect that idea, if at all possible. In other words, again, we're dealing with the problem of taking something from one language and putting it into another language that has a different grammatical system. And I think he's perhaps a little looser than he needs to be here. But what he's saying, he's probably dealing with the way things are translated by the translators themselves and the way you'll see these forms translated, not necessarily implying that it's totally justified. And so he has a few more comments on this in the last paragraph. But notice this little chart here. We have on one side eluon, the imperfect, and on the other side elusa, the aorist. And in the middle, he's got possible English equivalents. And he's got five of these. The first four of these, he says, can be a proper translation of eluon, and the last three can be a proper translation of elusa. So you see the two in the middle overlap. I loosed or I did loose might be an English translation for either one of those, depending on the context and what the context is conveying. And again, a particular translation of it is going to be dependent on the context in which it's said as well. So let's just go through these. I used to loose, or I was loosing. We have those two forms as possible translations of the imperfect, but not of the aorist, because the aorist will not have a progressive aspect definitely seen there, whereas the imperfect will. The imperfect will show you a progressive aspect. And so I used to loose is indicating a repeated action in the past, periodical repeated action. And that's certainly something that the imperfect can convey. Or I was loosing is indicating a clear progressive action in the past. And that's very akin to the very idea of the imperfect. Then when we have I loosed, I did loose, or I have loosed, those are all indefinite in aspect. And those three are all rendered over here by the Greek aorist. And the last one, I have loosed, is exclusively rendered by the aorist. In other words, you wouldn't translate an imperfect as I have loosed, but you might translate an aorist that way. And actually, that particular translation, if you saw what we'll see later on, called the perfect, that would be a very good translation of that. But this middle ground here, I loosed and I did loose, we've got that going both ways. Because you see, I loosed in English is ambiguous. It might mean just an indefinite aspect in a certain context. I loosed something. In a certain context, it might mean just an indefinite action that you did it and you don't really care about, you know, any more detail than that. However, in another context, it might in fact be progressive action. If the context is showing that it's progressive action, then you might see in some situations the Greek verb in the imperfect, and the English translated, I loosed, just because the rest of the context gives the information that the action was progressive, so you didn't need to come out and state it so much, saying something like I was loosing. The same as same with I did loose. I did loose has again got the same potential ambiguity. And so we might see in some situations a translation like that in English be the translation of either the imperfect or the aorist. So he's just telling you what you're liable to see in translations. Now, for your own on your own part, and this is the kind of way I think about it, there is a difference between the imperfect and the aorist in Greek. And so if I'm seeing a Greek passage, translating the scriptures, for example, and I note that there is an imperfect form there rather than an aorist form, I will want to make sure that my translation reflects the idea of a progressive action somehow. So I would be, in translating, trying to make it as clear as possible, I would use something like I was loosing or I used to loose, rather than one of these others that's more ambiguous. But you may not always see it. Not all translators, you know, adopt that convention, so you'll have to be prepared to see it other ways. But I think for yourselves, and then if you run into an aorist form, then a translation that's as indefinite as the Greek was might be appropriate. Something just like I loose, that leaves it kind of open. And that's really what you need to do with the aorist. Yes, Glenn?
But what you're saying is, in translating, it's not necessarily that that's really what it can mean. It's just you're trying to throw it towards
right.
the end to make it clear.
Right.
The translation.
Yes. Right. In other words, you're trying to come up with a translation that reflects that idea of the Greek, whether it's explicitly stated in those words or whether your context, the way you've translated with the context is showing that. That's the point he's going to bring up here in this next paragraph, is that sometimes it may be awkward to translate it, I was loosing, and try to make a clear statement of that progressive action because the context already made it so clear that it couldn't be anything else. And if that's the case, then you can get by with not translating it that way. But remember that you're still translating the whole idea that way because you've got the other context in addition to the words that you're using. So that's the big, this is the dilemma of the translator, you see. Now the translator has, you know, I've mentioned this before, but you really begin to develop a great compassion for translators after you've seen some of these things because it's not as simple as taking one word from one language and putting one word in another language. There are all these other factors involved in terms of the kind of aspect that's seen, etc., that don't always come out in a simple way or a consistent way in a given language. So let's look at this last paragraph. In translating the Greek imperfect, the student should not limit himself to translations of the I was loosing type. The Greek imperfect does, of course, refer to action in progress, but various English expressions may be used to represent this. So his point is that the Greek idea isn't changing, it's just that in English there's many ways to represent the idea. And sometimes the simple I loosed form is quite acceptable as a rendering of Greek imperfect, as the context may make it quite clear that the progressive action is meant, or that the activity was customary or enduring or something of the sort. When the context is sufficiently explicit, the I was loosing kind of translation frequently sounds awkward and overdone. Similarly, the Greek aorist very frequently refers to action which has been completed in the past, so that it often corresponds to the English perfect, I have loosed. Okay, well, that's something just to keep in mind, and as we begin to do more translating and get used to this, I'll try to make an effort to make sure that we point out this distinction as we're going and give you a better feeling for it. Now, of course, there's a difference, too, as a comment on this last paragraph. There's a difference between a translation that you are doing for the purpose of, the translators that are writing up, the New American Standard Translation, for example, they're trying to put the whole Bible in an English translation that follows English grammatical rules that a person who understands English can read through and find very pleasing and very understandable and so forth. And so when you've got that purpose in mind, then you're going to be especially careful to observe the kinds of things he said in this last paragraph, not translating something in such a way that's going to sound awkward or stilted or something like this. However, on the other hand, when you're doing exegesis, when you're very, very concerned about a precise representation of an idea, then it's more appropriate and you may find yourself giving a more stilted translation of something just to express the idea. That's what Rotherham does. His translation is not as smooth flowing and easy to read as some of the others, but it's more accurate to the ideas that the Greek is transmitting. And for the person that knows a little bit about Greek and Hebrew, that translation is very satisfying in that you're able to see from his translation things that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise. So it kind of depends on what your purpose in the translation is as well. Okay, any other questions on this? This distinction in meaning, though, I guess the only thing I would say to keep in mind is that imperfect has got progressive aspect, aorist is indefinite aspect. It's just pointing to the action without necessarily implying anything progressive or taking any period of time at all. Okay, now, before we move to chapter 14, we want to... Now, I'm not going to assign these exercises for next time because you've got a test next time. So after the test is over with, then we'll do lesson 13. So this will be a good time to take a little interlude here to go back to our accent rules for nouns, and at least this first and second declension nouns, and for the verbs. And the purpose of this is not to require you to memorize these accent rules. You'll be responsible for those general rules and the accents that we've already discussed for this test, as you know. But I want to take a look now at the more specific accent rules that deal with nouns and verbs, just so that we're starting to deal with verb paradigms now, and there's always the question, where does the accent go? And so we'll just talk about this, and you can apply these principles as you're doing your work, but remember, I'm not going to be holding you responsible for the location of the accent on a word in a test, unless we, you know, forms that we get to later on where it really makes a difference. So if you look at page 320 in the textbook, there are special rules of accent at the top of the page. Those general rules kind of gave you a number of restrictions and limitations, but they didn't really predict for you exactly where the accent will fall on a word. You need more information. And so this more information is what we're going to look at now. And with regard to first nouns, at least the nouns we've had so far, and then with regard to the verb forms that we've had so far. Now, we're not going to cover all of this section because some of it deals with third declension and a lot of it deals with other verb forms we haven't gotten to yet, infinitives, participles, and things like that. So we're going to touch those parts. But I do want you to be at least familiar with what's happening in these areas so that you're not always in confusion as to where the accent goes. At least you'll know something about it, even though you won't be required to duplicate all of this. Okay, special rules of accent, top of the page. It should be noticed that the general rules just given, the ones that we've already covered now, do not say how a word must be accented, only how it may be accented, or at most, how it must be accented in a rather particular circumstance. To determine where the accent of a particular word usually belongs, further information is necessary. Okay, section 393, rules of accent for nouns. In noun forms, the accent remains on the syllable which bears it in the nominative singular, unless it is prevented from doing so by the operation of one or more of the general rules of section of accent. In order to accent a noun form correctly, therefore, it is necessary to know where the accent is in the nominative singular. Since no general rule exists for determining this, it must be learned for each noun separately. So that's the first point. You've got to learn where the accent falls in the nominative form, in the dictionary form, when you're as a part of your vocabulary. The only way you can expect to be able to predict how it's going to, where it's going to occur in the other forms is to know how it occurred in the first form. See, that's as much a part of a word as anything else. In English, when you learn a vocabulary word, you learn where the stress falls as well. We don't have accent marks, but we still are learning the proper pronunciation. And from the dictionary, there are little markings to indicate where the accent falls for you so that you can learn the word right. You know, you've heard people who put the emphasis on the wrong syllable, you know, of a word, and it sounds wrong. Well, the word sounds wrong, the right letters, but the wrong emphasis. Well, the same is true in Greek. It's just a matter of learning where the accent comes. Now, in Greek, it's a little bit more complicated because you also have to learn whether it's a circumflex or an acute, and that's maybe a little bit more information, but still, the essential idea is that you've got to learn it in the nominative form. Then, once you've got it from the nominative form, if it's a noun, when you put it in the declension and begin to see what the other forms are, you may find that putting different endings on the thing is going to affect where the accent falls. And that's simply due to the fact that in the nominative form, at least for first and second declension, or let's say second declension masculines, the ending of the ending itself in the nominative form is a short vowel, and being a short vowel, the accent can fall on one of the any one of the last three syllables. But if, see, once you go to the genitive and dative, the suffix is long. And the suffix being long now, that is putting more restrictions on where the accent can fall on the word. Remember, by the general rules, if the last syllable, ultima, is long, then the accent can only fall on one of the last two syllables. So if you have a word in which the accent fell on the antepenult in the nominative form, it won't be able to fall on the antepenult in the genitive and dative forms. It's going to have to move in order to satisfy the rules. So this is the central point. Now, we mentioned this before, but a few examples, he says, will make clear how the rule of accent for nouns operates. Example 1, the nominative singular of anthropos has an acute accent on the antepenult. In the genitive and dative singular forms of this word, however, the ultima is long, so that by general rule 5a of section 391, the antepenult cannot have an accent. Accordingly, the accent is moved to the penult in these forms. So we get anthropou and anthropo, where it was anthropos in the nominative, and is returned to the antepenult in the accusative singular, anthropon. That's okay because the omicron nu suffix is short, vowel. So you can go ahead and put the accent back where it was. Okay, the fluctuation of the accent in the plural forms anthropoi, anthropon, anthropois, and anthropous is explained the same way. Let me ask you this. Why is the accent on the first syllable an anthropoi, since you have an omicron iota there, it's a diphthong at the end?
It's short.
Yeah, it's considered short. Right, it's considered short. When omicron iota or alpha iota are final, they're considered short. But notice the rest of the endings, though, are all long. The omicron iota in anthropois is not final. There's a sigma after it. And so because of that, it's considered long. And omicron upsilon sigma is obviously long. Omega nu is obviously long. So all of those are going to have the accent shifted down one syllable. Okay, now, example 2. In the nominative singular of doulos, the nominative singular of doulos has a circumflex accent on the penult. But in the genitive and dative singular, this must be changed to an acute, since a circumflex can stand on the penult only when the ultima is short. Okay, so remember by the rule, if the ultima is long, the final syllable is long, then the circumflex can't stand on the penult. And it was only if it was short it could stand on the penult. So since you've got two long syllables in a row here is what's happening. The final syllable is long, and then the syllable before it's long. And the syllable before it, originally, when it was short, doulos had the circumflex, but the circumflex has to change to an acute here because by the rules, the circumflex can't stand on the penult if the ultima is long. So that requires a change. Now, the stress hasn't changed its position. It's only changed the kind of accent. And so it's changed from a circumflex to an acute. Does anybody have a problem with that? Do you understand that? It refers back to rule. Let me get the right one here. If the ultima is long, rule 5b is what's involved. If the ultima is long, the penult, if accented, may only have the acute. Okay, Mike, do you have a question?
Is it true to say that the accent will attempt to stay on the original syllable unless these general rules kick it off?
Right, exactly. The accent will try to stay on the syllable that it was on originally unless these rules force it off. And there's maybe only one, it's not really an exception to that, but there is a feature that gets involved in the first declension, which we'll get to in the next page, where certain forms are always going to have the accent in a certain place. But other than that, that's essentially it. If it'll stay where it is unless some of these rules are violated and it forces it off. Okay, then example 3. The nominative singular of prophetes has an acute accent on the penult. In the nominative plural, however, this must be changed to a circumflex. Now we get the reverse direction. We're changing acute to a circumflex. Prophetai, since by the rule of accent for nouns, it must remain in the position that it has in the nominative singular, but also since by general rule 4b, section 391, an accented long penult must have a circumflex if the ultima is short. Remember that rule said that if the ultima is short, then the penult, if accented, is going to have a circumflex if it itself is long, an acute if it itself is short. Okay, now, what's happened here in this paradigm is that we've gone from a long ending to a short ending. So we had a long ending before, which and the accent was on the penult. And if the suffix, if the ending is long, if the ultima is long, the penult, if it's got the accent, can only have the acute. However, when once you change that to a short ending and you've still got a long penult, then the rule for the short ending applies, and the penult, if accented, must have a circumflex if it itself is long, and an acute if it itself is short. So since it's long, and since the ultima is short, now we've got to go to a circumflex. Okay? But we haven't changed the position of the accent, that's okay, but the kind of accent has changed.
So if you look at this prophetai,
mm-hmm.
it was prophetais.
Mm-hmm.
Dative.
Yes, dative plural.
Then that would be an acute.
Right, so. Right. Yes, prophetais would be an acute because, again, prophetais would be long. And once it's and if it's long, see, and actually all the plurals except for the nominative plural are going to be have the acute because of that, because they've got all long suffixes. So the long ultima means that the accent on the penult is going to have to be an acute. But if the ultima goes short, then the accent is going to, since the penult in this case is a long vowel, it's going to have to be a circumflex. Okay. So that's how these rules interweave. You know, you find yourself after a while wondering which, you know, it at first, you know, there seems to be a lot of complications there, and it's easy to forget some of these things. That's why we are not requiring you, and I don't want you to take the time in a test or something to try to figure up all these rules and figure out where the accent goes, unless you've got extra time. You get done with the test ahead of time, and you want to have some fun, you know, and you want to go through and check all the forms, make sure you get the accent in the right place. That's perfectly all right, but don't put emphasis on the accent position to the exclusion of other things. You've only got so many brain cells there, and there's so much information that's being jammed in, that I would rather that you, and this is typical of the Greek classes, since the accents are normally not going to be determining meaning, it's not worth the effort if you've only got so much capacity up there to try to jam it full of things that are not the most important thing. But I do want to cover this just because there's always that curiosity when you see a form and you're wondering why this and why that, and this will tell you why, and you will be able to figure out in a given case once you know the nominative form, but and there are reasons, and there is a rhyme or reason to it, but it may not be something that's worth taking all the time to make sure you get in every case. Was there a question back here? Yes, Jim?
Is the best way to look at these words for the accent is
mm-hmm.
look at the ending and see if it's long or short, then apply the rules from there.
Yes, that's the main thing. Now there are some other factors involved in to a certain extent, but in those first limiting rules. But everything really comes down to rule 4 and 5 there, and the subcategories. When it comes to noun declensions, the essential issue is whether that suffix is long or short. That's what's going to cause changes. If you change the suffix from long or short, that's going to cause these problems. So. In some cases, if the antepenult was accented in the nominative form, the accent is actually going to shift to a different syllable. In the rest of the cases, the kind of accent, if it's, the accent happens to be on the penult in the first place, then there may be some changes along those lines. If the accent's on the ultima to start with, there's usually not going to be too much that's going to happen because the ultima is you know, the last syllable isn't going to involve much of a change anyway. So. That's basically it there as far as these nouns are concerned. Now, if you look at section 394, it says more detailed rules are necessary for accenting certain classes of nouns. Number one, in the first and second declensions, an acute on the ultima in the nominative singular is changed to a circumflex in the genitive and dative, singular and plural. Now, this is something you really wouldn't be able to predict because you see an ultima can have either the circumflex or the acute, and there's not going to be too much change involved necessary because you're dealing with the ultima. You're not really, you know, you can add things to the front without affecting that. You're not really going to be forcing some changes. However, he's noting that in the first and the second declensions both, if the accent happens to be on the ultima in the nominative form, then if you have an acute accent on the ultima, that will change to a circumflex in the genitive and dative. Look at the paradigms here and you'll see what I mean. We have Tim-A, that's got an acute on the ultima. But in the genitive and dative, that acute turns to a circumflex. Timais, Timae, and then Timain, back to the acute. And then we have the acute on the nominative and accusative forms in the plural, but then the circumflex on the genitive and dative forms. So now this is accent. This is only dealing with when the accent's on the ultima. And the same is true with mathetes. Notice that we've got the acute in the nominative and accusative, but the circumflex in the genitive and dative. Hodos, same thing. Hieron, same thing. So in first and second declension, if the accent's on the ultima, an acute on the ultima in the nominative will be changed to a circumflex in the genitive and dative. Okay, and this is not unlike the article paradigm. Remember, if you take a look at the article paradigm, you'll notice that in the genitives and dative you've got circumflexes, and the other ones, some of them are, the nominative is enclitic in the singulars, but you've got the acute and the accusative there. So that's a pattern you get used to after a while. Now, in the first declension, a few more notes. And again, I don't want you to take the time to try to memorize all of this, but it's just to help you when you're seeing things to have some knowledge of where it came from. In the first declension, part A, if alpha is short in the ending of the nominative singular, it is also short in the accusative singular. Thus, aletheia, being accented on the antipenult, must have its final alpha short. Remember we said earlier that alpha may be either long or short? And the question is, how do you know whether it's long or short? Well, this is one of the ways. In a word like aletheia, what is telling you that alpha has to be short? Well, simply because the antipenult is accented. Now, if the alpha were long, you couldn't accent the antipenult. If the alpha were considered long, for example, where would the accent have to fall on this word? You know, aletheia, over the epsilon iota. Or at least that's the furthest back it could come. It might be on the alpha, too, but if the alpha is long, you can't have the accent on the eta there. But the fact that the accent is on the eta, and that's what you learn in the dictionary form, tells you that the alpha has to be considered short here. Okay, now, if the alpha is considered short there, then he's saying that it will also be considered short in the accusative, aletheion. So in other words, it's going to be consistent. Similarly, if the alpha is long in the ending of the nominative singular, it is also long in the accusative singular. So basileia, with an acute accent in its on its long penult, must have final alpha long. Accordingly, its accusative singular is basileion. So basically, he's just telling you that the accusative is going to follow suit with the nominative. And alpha can either be long or short, and you'll determine that by the nominative form as to where the stress falls, and that will follow through to the accusative. It won't change.
Right.
Yes?
At its point of necessity, then, if it falls on the penult, you can just say that that's a long vowel on the end.
Yes, you have to. If it's an acute on the penult, you have to say it's long in the end. Yeah, just if it falls on the penult, period. Yeah, you pretty much have to say that's a long alpha in the end. So, it wouldn't necessarily, have to be. You see, it's possible to have a short ending and still get a long and still get an accent on the penult. That's possible. But I guess it's just a convention they're adopting as to whether they call the thing long or short, and to be consistent. What's that?
Backward reason. On the other ones, you determine where the accent goes according to what the...
Yes,
the,
I know.
Here you determine what the end is according to the accent.
Yeah, I know. Again, grammarians are just, inventing rules to try to help them figure out what the forms are, and that's really what this is all about. A person could call it long or short, or another person could just change the make the rule differently where it didn't demand a distinction between long or short and just tell you to memorize this thing and not worry about it. But they're trying to give you some kind of a thing to relate to try to figure it out, so that's about all you could do with it. All right, then B, regardless of the position of the accent in the nominative singular, nouns of the first declension have a circumflex on the ultima in the genitive plural. This constitutes an important exception to the basic rule for noun accent given in beginning in section 393. So remember the thing he's referring to there is that the accent will stay on the syllable that it started out with unless the rules force it to change. He's saying this is an exception to that because in the first declension, no matter where the accent occurred, in the genitive plural, is always going to be a circumflex over that omega. So, and that is an exception to the rule because the accent rules themselves would never demand that. But he's saying that that's what happens. So with Tim A, the genitive plural is Timon with a circumflex over the nu, omega nu. With Mathetes, same thing. With Kome, same thing. With Prophetes, same thing. And with Thalassa, that has a stress on the antipenult, it's still Thalasson. So that one changes, and this is now dealing only with first declension. And nouns of the first declension have circumflex in the ultima in the genitive plural, straight across the board, regardless of where the accent was in the first place. That's only genitive plural now, not the rest of the plurals. Okay, well, we'll mention a couple more features, and then we'll talk about the verb accents after we finish our test on Tuesday. Maybe it'll be next Wednesday. I guess we'll get to that. Okay. The puzzle gets more complicated each day. More pieces. Yes. Okay.